This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Jennifer Daniels. I knew Jennifer had been making music and writing songs with her husband, Jeff Neal. I've known them for more than two decades now, and we've talked about the songs together any number of times. But this is the first time I realised that Jennifer's also a writer. She has just published her third novel, The Lock Box, but she's been writing essays as well as novels for publication all along, and she's good. At least this novel is good. It's a love story and a mystery written at the behest of her mother, who wanted a love story without too many awkward details. The book is called The Lock Box.
Yes.
Why lock. Is it called The Lock Box?
Oh, well, lock is L-O-C-K-E.
I know, it's a play, yeah, on the name of the family.
Yes.
In the story.
Yes. And so very soon into the story, one of the characters is gifted with this skeleton key, and they have no idea what it fits. But that's what they have to spend the rest of the time finding out. So these two strangers are sort of thrown together, and this bizarre car crash leaves them to take care of a baby and a pregnant cat, and then they get this key. So they have to form this really strong alliance, but really fast, in order to, you know, kind of break this mystery that is happening and stay out of trouble and keep their little, you know, quasi family intact.
It's a really interesting situation. It's two strangers. One is called Emma, right? And the other one is called
Locke.
He goes by his last name.
This becomes a huge theme throughout the book, because he doesn't even want to be known as his first name. Like, his granddaddy's made it clear to him his whole life, you know, every time you go out the door, you have to vote. You have to vote whose man you are. You get three choices. You get to vote for two of them. And the candidates are God, Locke, as in their surname, and self. And you have to vote every time you leave the door. If you want to live your life right, you got to vote.
Interesting idea. So Emma is in a graveyard. Emma has a somewhat romantic idea about headstones and names. And,
yes.
One of the names on one of the headstones becomes a significant personality in the story.
Yes.
And while she is in the graveyard, she's gone there on a bicycle. She meets Locke, who pops up from behind one of the headstones.
Startles her. Makes her real mad because he startled her, and she doesn't like that.
Next thing you know, a car runs out of control, bangs into a headstone, and almost T-bones the two of them. And that's where the baby came from.
Right.
And the mother is, well, there's some question about that.
Yes.
The mother is a victim on a number of levels. She's obviously a victim of a crash, but was she a victim before the crash? That's one of the questions. Locke, just about a year before, has lost his twin brother.
Yes.
Who's died. His twin brother, and I didn't think about that until you were talking about the skeleton key, his twin brother likes to make boxes.
Yes. Yes, he does.
Boxes that are like puzzle pieces.
Yes.
And one, they figure out how to open and put it back together, and the other one, they can't quite figure that out. It's, as one person, I think, said on Amazon, it's a very warm story. Emma is from Michigan. She teaches sign language.
Uh-huh.
And that's a whole story in itself, which is
kind
of interesting. And she's moved to Texas. And this is, I'm assuming this is her first job?
Yes, teaching? This is her first professional job. She's pretty young. She got her doctorate very young.
Well, she's kind of driven.
She's very driven. She's a fiery little creature. She's got this wild orange hair. She's small. I'm saying little because she actually is a small in height, but makes up for all of it in her attitude.
Well, now you say that, kind of brings to mind, I can't remember the name of it, but there was a cartoon a few years ago, your children probably know it, with the little girl that has the fiery red hair and fires arrows.
I don't know. Do you mean the Disney film?
Yeah.
Oh, Merida. Yeah, Merida. What's the
name? Is that her name?
She's got that. In fact,
she wants to, because she wants to be a warrior, and they say no because you're a girl.
Yes, right? Exactly. Right. In fact, my daughter took a picture of Merida and gave her like Emma's clothes and like, look, here's Emma. She made that connection too. Maybe that was in my mind. I don't know.
So suffice to say that Emma is relatively small of stature and lots of hair that she's kind of self-conscious about. She doesn't really like it. And that's one of the two parts of her anatomy that Locke loves to tease her about. But they bond in a way that on the face of it, you say, wait a minute. How could two people bond that closely, that quickly?
Right.
But it's because of the baby.
the baby.
They both feel this responsibility to take care of the baby who was in the car that crashed and her mother died.
And they've been through this trauma, and they're also in fear for their own safety, and it bonds them very quickly, having spent this whole day in the graveyard waiting for the police to do their job and more secrets being revealed.
And Emma becomes a target almost immediately.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's an interesting quirk of what appears to be an interesting quirk to me anyway, of the legal system in Texas that says if you are a teacher, you can be a foster parent.
So you know where I got this idea is my friend Julie teaches in Dalton, Georgia, and that's true of them. And sometimes maybe a lot of people who've come in from below the border, sometimes parents will be gone when the child's getting out of school, and the child will have to have somewhere to stay. And so the teachers will take them into their homes because they're automatically certified to be caregivers as foster parents. So I thought we need Locke's mom as a teacher to be able to give this kid foster status.
It just occurred to me, one of the things I was going to ask you is if you would read something from the book.
Sure. Maybe I'll just read these first couple pages, since we're talking about the cemetery anyway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This is the first time I've gotten to do it, Richard. This is the first time I've gotten to read from my book in a book interview. I'm so excited. I have to get the smile off my face so I can do it. Okay, here we go. Chapter 1, The Locke Family Plot. This is why you keep pedaling, because occasionally this. With a foot planted on either side of my bike, I remove my helmet to congratulate myself on what lies at the end of this trail, an old cemetery, peculiar in its beauty and remote. So remote, I suspect it has fallen into disuse. It seems indecent to ride into such a place. I leave the woods on foot, blinking against sudden sunlight, wading knee-deep through the grass of several solemn acres. Mammoth brown headstones mark the graves, some of them ancient by American standards, and amassed in groups according to kin. At least that's what I'm gathering from the clusters of common surnames. There are several dead Locks. As I explore, the garden's quietude begins to seduce my imagination. The tips of grass tickle my palms and spread gossip about me from hill to hill. Morning light filters through the sprawling oaks like ethereal stairways. I envision winged angels ascending to the heavens, having just plucked the recent dead. Oh, and the Spanish moss that drapes from the branches? Tangled snakes, silent guardians of the reaper's process. When I come upon the next gravestone, Annabelle Locke's, I begin to wish that my imagination had not become such an active participant, and that I had just stuck to considering the dead people's names as potential options for future children. Despite the serenity of the place, or maybe because of it, I find myself quite jumpy. So in an effort to ground myself, I chide the grave's unfortunate tenant out loud. It was creepy of you, Annabelle, to die on my birthday. Annabelle is not arguing. Even so, I make my sternest teacher face and tell her that yes, it was. Now that that's settled, I amble to the next outcropping. But when something unnatural slinks into my periphery, I spin my whole body around to confront it. A man's head has appeared over the top of Annabelle's stone, and I shriek. Maybe it was creepy of you, the head says, to be born on her death day. I choke back the flare of annoyance that follows the embarrassment that follows the fright. The head is clearly amused. It says, with some effort at decorum, I didn't mean to startle you. I was sitting back against the stone when you spoke. She was my great-great-grandmother. By this time, the head's whole body has risen into view, and the gravestone, which is nearly shoulder height for me, is hardly chest height for it. It holds out a hand for me to shake. Broad frame, nice cheekbones, strong evidence that it hasn't held a razor in days. I feel slightly more agreeable. I concede that it is certainly and solidly a living man. I think that, before the spark of laughter, at my expense, gray clouds had overcast his late summer green eyes. It's a lovely name, I manage, but I do not shake his hand. I haven't told it to you yet. He bestows a suggestive nod at the hand I am not shaking. I mean Annabelle, I say, your great-great-grandmother. Oh, right. And I'm Locke. Locke combs back layers of shoulder-length brown hair with the hand in contention, then reaches it out again. Well, Landon, he corrects, but everybody calls me Locke. I've always wanted hair like that, My wild mane is nearly untamable, and it is certainly orange. I'm annoyed all over again. In Texas, Locke says, as if he's educating a foreigner or a child, we shake hands when we meet. I put mine out, so, and then you grasp it. It's a sign of good faith. I regard the outstretched appendage and shake my head. No, I'm not going to. Not till you can give me a good excuse for walking around with hair like that. What? He laughs. He's unused to being declined. Of course he is. Look at him. All shiny and obedient and showing off your bone structure. I wave my water bottle at that bone structure and peruse it with a scowl. Anyway, we can't become acquainted with your great-great-grandmother's gothic headstone standing between us. It's bad luck. Locke lifts his head up, but points his attention down at my feet. It's only bad luck for the person standing right on top of her, he says. I take a decisive step sideways and cut my eyes at him in a way that makes him chuckle. It's a really nice sound. Should I stop there? I'll stop there. I could read the whole thing.
But it's so cool. You have this way of auguring everybody, at least the two main characters anyway, come with some considerable baggage.
They do. Don't we all?
By that point, yeah, we've accrued it, right?
Right.
Locke is aptly named. And while he's expansive and friendly, clearly easy on the eye, he's kind of closed inside. Emma has her own issues. It seems to me that one of the reasons that she so readily accepts responsibility for the baby is because, and the fact that she's in the graveyard looking at potential baby names on the headstones, mm-hmm. is that Emma comes from a broken family, and so she's looking to heal that wound.
Absolutely. She wants to keep and to be kept, and yet it's the exact thing she's terrified of not finding anyone who will be faithful, who will stick around. And so, you know, even on the back of the book, that's how we quickly introduce her. She longs for someone to stick around, and yet the only creature she trusts is this pregnant stray cat that she feeds every day. And she's you know, skeptical about that. She's like, the only reason this cat sticks around is because it needs me. And this is the same way she ends up feeling about everybody in her life, including God, although it's not a story about God or faith, not primarily. But every person in her life she treats as if I can't give them something, they're not going to stick around. And that is why she draws in stray cats and this baby. She latches onto it so quickly. She wants to keep and to give and to be needed.
And she's also moved almost entirely across the country.
Yes.
Michigan to Texas. That's a big leap.
That's a big leap.
You know, not only culturally,
but I mean, it's not across the pond.
Physically, you know? No, that's true. But,
yeah.
You know, that culture keeps coming up.
It does.
That she's in Texas, and it clearly is not the way of living that she's used to.
Right. I think it's funny that the sheriff in the graveyard, he's looking around. He says, do you have people? As he's questioning her, and she's like, looks at Locke like, what in the world is he asking? And she says, no, I do not have people, which, you know, makes Locke laugh. He's like, he means, do you have family buried in this graveyard? And she's like, is that a Texas? Like, there's so many fun Southern things that happen that when I look at it from someone from a Northerner's point of view, it just gives me the giggles to write about it. And one of my favorite reviews was talking about that the story was a gothic mystery and it didn't have any castles, but she even said in the review, this is Southern, y'all. And I love that. Like, if I could take that one, this is Southern, y'all. It is. I embrace that wholeheartedly.
That's interesting. How do you do that? Because you are Southern in every sense, right? You grew up here.
Right.
This is your world. How are you able to stand outside the world and see it from the perspective of somebody who's an outsider like that?
I thank my roommate, Julie, who was from Boston, and my college roommate, Julie, was from Boston. One of the things everybody asked me, did you do research in Texas? How do you get the ideas for your songs? Or why did you write the song Ohio? How could you know about? But Jeff and I, for 24 years now, have been on the road constantly and spending weeks at a time in different regions, especially of our country, and just getting to meet those people, getting to know that if you're in Wisconsin, the best cheese curds squeak when you bite into them. Like, we know these neat little details about places, and we've gotten, you know, these firsthand crash courses in different cultures in the U.S. The last time I was in Texas, I had gone to teach at a do a keynote at a conference for early childhood educators, discussing music and movement as it relates to the classroom, and just an easy, fun conference. And I spent a lot of time just exploring while I was there. And I saw this one field full of those huge elephantine longhorn cattle, you know. And I couldn't believe how massive the horns were. And there were these donkeys, these tiny donkeys, alongside these huge beasts. And later, I got back to the conference and was just asking some of the participants, I was telling them about, you know, how I was exploring and talking about these donkeys. And they say, yeah, well, they keep the longhorns and the donkeys together for protection. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, that's so nice. These huge longhorns protect the donkeys. They're like, no, no, the donkeys protect the longhorns. And to me, this is an image of Emma and Locke. Emma gives Locke, who is this fortress of a man, and she's this little bitty thing. She gives him back so much of himself. He feels lost. He's grieving his brother. He has unanswered questions. His brother has apparently committed suicide, and yet they've been twins, and he just can't believe his brother wouldn't have let him in on what was going on with him. And so Emma's like this little donkey, right? This stubborn little donkey that gives Locke back so much of his own self as they become closer and closer.
This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Our guest is songwriter and novelist Jennifer Daniels. Her latest novel just published is titled The Locke Box. Along with the novel, she is also about to release an album that parallels the novel, with some of the songs referencing the characters and plot points in the story. This is a song called Read the Last Page First.
I can tell that you've lost your way. It's been 12 months ago to the day. I would yell him right out of his grave if I could. If you'd let me into your house, I'd be as still and as quiet as a mouse. Baby, I will help you smother the doubt if I could. But the sun keeps on rising like we've got a future. Your lips on mine mend the wound like a suture. Call up your fallen will, finally rise up again. Read the last page first and often. Just give me the right to read the last page first tonight. Pumpkin and tangerine bread, kisses that go to your head. I would things to destroy the dread if I could. It's been 12 months today and you need a reminder. The death gets his ass kicked when you look behind you. All of your fallen are finally standing again. Read the for every eyes cold.
There, he's a donkey. Somebody put that on the poster.
You also have twins.
I do have twins. Yeah, oh, we thought a lot about twins. I met a guy the other day who has mirror twins, which are identical in DNA, apparently. I probably will get this wrong. But one of them is right-handed, one of them is left-handed. Sometimes the organs of mirror twins will be switched, like looking in a mirror. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that's amazing. But ours are boy-girl. Even Ooh. They still get asked, are you identical? But they are not. They're very different.
But at some point, you talk about, as they're twins, they've grown up very close to one another, mm-hmm. but they're different.
They're incredibly different personality-wise, yeah. Yes. Lox is an artist. He's he crafts wood and furniture, and he's a man of peace, a man of wisdom. And his brother liked to fight. His brother liked to, you know, all the paintball and the hunting, and so they were different that way. Kind of a Jacob and Esau thing.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming that comes from your observation of your own twins, because as you were saying before, they're different too.
They're very different.
Even though they're twins, they were born at the same time and from the same parents. And that's interesting in itself, really, isn't it? Two little beings.
Yes. We'll all be in the car driving, and they will spontaneously begin chants and songs and then start doing harmony and parts that we've never heard them practicing before. Like, they just have this really amazing complementary bond. Now, this is not to say that they don't also hit each other in the head and push each other around. Certainly, they are siblings. And yet, their personalities are so very different, but so complementary. And that is kind of what I saw in Landon and Aaron, the Locke twins in the book. They very different personalities, and yet they were so very bonded to the point where Locke can guess what Aaron's passwords were for his phone or his laptop. And in fact, the whole thing revolves around the fact that he thinks Aaron must have left him more information than he's gotten, and that's what he and Emma have to find in order to keep themselves safe and to sort of unravel this mystery that goes on.
Yeah, which for Locke, at least, the mystery is that he just can't bring himself to believe that Aaron would take his own life.
Right.
And he's bound and determined he's going to prove that didn't happen.
Right, yes. And he's like, I know, and no family can believe it when it happens to them, but it didn't happen. I swear it didn't happen. This is like, my folks got divorced when I was an adult, but I remember telling one of my friends, and just, I was at that point where I was still very grieved over the separation, and one of my friends said to me, oh, that's horrible, and she's sympathizing, and she says, I know my parents would never get divorced. And in my mind, I'm thinking, don't you think that's where I was? I was shocked as anyone, just amazed. And this is the sort of thing with Landon. He's thinking, this couldn't happen. This absolutely couldn't happen. Happens to other people.
While Emma is convinced that her dad stopped caring about her, that she watched him literally drive away.
Yes.
Thinking, oh, he's not going to do that. He's going to turn around.
She thinks it so hard, it becomes a memory in her mind, the three-point turn. Yeah, the brake lights and the three-point turn. She sees it like a memory in her mind because she believes so hard he won't leave her. And there he went.
So in that sense, she has something in common with the Locke.
Yes.
You know,
they both
have this sort of family mystery, if you will.
Yes, that's part of what they are. That's why they work so well, is they are both searching for a forever family and both can't believe that it could happen to them at the same time.
Jennifer Daniels just published a novel, is titled The Locke Box. The companion album, Songs from the Locke Box, is set for release at the end of next month. Details on the album and the novel are on her website, jenniferdaniels.com. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.